Hello and welcome to Greatest Britons. Today's Greatest Briton is Major General Charles Gordon, and it is the second episode because there is so much to talk about with this wonderful man. And of course, your hosts for the episode are myself, Sven Longshanks, and Max Musson from Western Spring. Well, let's change the subject now, Max, and get into our Greatest Britons with General Gordon, Major General Charles George Gordon, also known as Chinese Gordon, Gordon Pasha, and Gordon of Khartoum. And we're going to be talking about why he is called Gordon of Khartoum today. We will talk about his interactions with the Islamic State of 1835. Gordon, well, let's have a little recap of where we got to last week. We heard how Gordon was made the governor of the Sudan, where he abolished torture and public floggings, and he worked to end slavery. We heard about Gordon's interaction with Mr. Baring from Baring's Bank, who he didn't have a very high opinion of. We heard about Gordon stopping an uprising, and he convinced the slavers to actually work for his administration, and he walks right into their camp unarmed. Shortly after that, he tries to broker a peace between Egypt and Abyssinia, and he fails. He gets imprisoned, and then he's forced to admit failure, basically. And his failure in what he wanted to do, because he wanted to reform everything in the Sudan, but he was really working against the establishment. The Arabs didn't want to change, basically. The Ottomans didn't want to change. They wanted to keep slavery. And some of the Africans wanted to keep slavery as well. So every time that he would free these slaves, they would just get sold on again by people further up the administration. Incredibly corrupt, basically. The third world administrations are incredibly corrupt. So he went back to Britain, had a bit of a nervous breakdown, and then he went to China again, but this time without British permission. And the British said, well, look, you've got to come back because there could be an international diplomatic incident if you resign your British citizenship and go fighting for the Chinese against the Russians. So he then comes back to Britain. He goes over to Ireland and is horrified to see the level of poverty that there is in Ireland. And he campaigns to change the system in Ireland, and he basically says that the British Empire should pay for all the lands that the Anglo-Irish have got there and give them back to the Irish. And he compares that to the British Empire buying the slaves from all the slave masters. And he says that this would solve all the problems that we have in Ireland. And he was correct, because after that we did get the partition, and we've had the troubles and everything else. And he also fell out with Prime Minister Gladstone over this, because he highlighted the fact that Gladstone actually came from a family that owned slaves. And he was saying, well, look, your family were bailed out for this. So they were paid for this, and the slaves were given their freedom. Why don't you do the same in Ireland? Why don't you do the same and set these poor Irish free? And Gladstone was not very happy about that. And of course, this highlights the fact that in Britain, we were more concerned about how black slaves were treated in America than we actually were about how white slaves, essentially white slaves, were treated in Britain. Is there anything else you want to add to that, Max, that you remember from last week, or want to?
No, I think that's a good summary, actually.
Okay, well,
just shows Gordon as being a top guy, really, doesn't it?
Yeah, he really is. He's a real hero of the empire, I think, a real archetypal British Empire man. Well, in the year 1881, which was the Islamic year 1298, to mark the coming of the new century, the self-proclaimed Mahdi, Mohammed Ahmed, announced that he was the Mahdi, a messianic figure in Islam which tradition holds will appear at the dawn of every new Islamic century to strike down the enemies of Islam. And this Mahdi pronounced a jihad against the Egyptian state. The long exploitation of the Sudan by Egypt led many Sudanese to rally to the Mahdi's black banner as he promised to expel the Egyptians, who Ahmed denounced as apostates. And before announcing that he would establish an Islamic fundamentalist state, marking a return to the pure Islam said to have been practiced in the days that Muhammad lived in Arabia. So I'll just stop there, because there's a lot there. He's using exactly the same black banner as ISIS, used today. It's exactly the same terminology as ISIS used today. And back then it was against the Ottomans, who have alcohol legal, and they're fairly Western. And today we've got them doing the same thing against Syria, which again is fairly Westernized. They don't make people wear the veil. You can buy alcohol there. They're fairly secular. So the same thing is happening today as was happening back then. The only difference is today that we haven't actually got a self-proclaimed Mahdi, which they did back then. So to think that, today we had no idea that that was coming from Islam is a nonsense, because this is only 140 years ago. We had exactly the same situation happening in Egypt. Do you want to add anything to that?
People say that if we don't learn from history, then history will repeat itself. And what this demonstrates is that from the 1800s, or since the 1800s, we haven't learned from history as far as Islam is concerned.
No, we've learned nothing from history, or our leaders apparently have learned nothing from it. I think we, as nationalists, we certainly have learned from it. Additionally, Baring's policy of raising taxes to pay off the debts that Ismail had run up had sparked much resentment in both Egypt and the Sudan. And remember, last week, Gordon had come up with a plan to prevent all of this from happening, to prevent all this civil unrest from happening. He said, can Baring's Bank, can you hold off on the debt for a certain amount of time, and we'll just pay a little bit off, and then we'll pay the interest off. But Baring's said, no, we can't have that. And the result of that is now this Islamic unrest. In 1882, nationalist rage in Egypt against Baring's economic policies led to the revolt by Colonel Urabi Pasha, which was then put down by British troops. From September 1882 onwards, Egypt was a de facto British protectorate, effectively ruled by Baring from the bank. Though in theory, Egypt remained an Ottoman province with a very wide degree of autonomy until 1914. With Egypt under British rule, the British also inherited the problems of Egypt's colony, the Sudan, which the Egyptians were fast losing control of to the Mahdi. After losing many battles and the destruction of an army, the Liberal Prime Minister, William Gladstone, decided that the Sudan was not worth the trouble it would take to hang on to, and as such it was to be abandoned to the Mahdi. In December 1883, the British government ordered Egypt to abandon the Sudan, but that was difficult to carry out as it involved the withdrawal of thousands of Egyptian soldiers, civilian employees, and their families. And again, I'll just stop there. I mean, it's like today when the IMF loan out all this money to the third world and they can't pay it back. And they say, well, you've got to change all your policies. You've got to change all your taxing. You've got to promote homosexuality. You've got to promote transgenderism. This is the sort of thing they say in the EU in particular, in order to get money. And basically, it was just a lot more naked back then. You've actually got the Baring's Bank, the de facto rulers of Egypt, because of these debts that they managed to get the head of Egypt to run up. I mean, it's really irresponsible banking, basically, but I think that, you know, that's the reason why they do it. It's the same as what when they give out mortgages to people that can't pay them back. It means that the bank can then repossess the house. The bank has created the money. It hasn't cost them anything to create the money. It's cost them nothing at all to print it or put the thing on the balance sheet there. But then once it can't be paid back, then they have actually got physical property that the bank then owns. So it's made physical property out of loaning out this money. And the same thing here. We got Baring's Bank taking over an entire country because they irresponsibly loaned out money to the head of the country. And of course, it's very tempting to say, well, that's the deliberate policy. That's why they have done that, is so that they can take over the country. Do you want to add anything to that, Max?
It's what people would call financial imperialism, isn't it? It's the creation of an empire through the manipulation of money and lending irresponsibly, lending to people that, where you know that they haven't got the ability to repay the loan, is usury. And so it would appear that Baring's Bank were up to their armpits in usury at that time. And again, it's another lesson that the current leaders of the West have failed to recognize.
Well, yeah, I mean, the bank crash in 2008, that was caused by all these home loans to people that couldn't pay them back in America. Yep. We regularly get these economic crashes like that. And again, we can see that this was happening 140 years ago. We knew all of this, and yet it's still going on today. And we've got another bit coming up now, which is the same as today, and that's media manipulation. While staying with his sister in Southampton, Gordon received an unexpected visitor, namely William Thomas Stead, the editor of the Pall Mall Gazette, with whom Gordon reluctantly agreed to do an interview. He wanted to talk about the Congo, where he had been asked to go by King Leopold II, but Stead kept on pressing him to talk about the Sudan. Finally, after much prompting on Stead's part, Gordon opened up and attacked Gladstone's Sudan policy, coming out in favour of an intervention to crush the Mahdi. Gordon offered up a 19th century anticipation of the domino theory, claiming, "The danger arises from the influence which the spectacle of a conquering Mohammedan power established close to your frontiers will exercise upon the population which you govern. In all the cities of Egypt, it will be felt that what the Mahdi has done, they may do. And as he has driven out the intruder, they may do the same." And these are wise words that he's saying here. He's saying that if you allow this to take place, the countries around will follow and do the same thing. Well, Stead published his interview on the 9th of January, 1884, on the front page of the Pall Mall Gazette, alongside the editorial he had written entitled "Chinese Gordon for the Sudan." Urban wrote, "With this leader, William Stead's real motive in going to Southampton revealed itself at last. As to who tipped him off that the general would be staying here for just a couple of nights, we can only speculate." So he's also implying here that Gladstone is in Southampton to see Gordon. Well, Stead's interview caused a media sensation and led to a popular clamour for Gordon to be sent to the Sudan. Urban wrote, "The Pall Mall Gazette articles, in short, began a new chapter in international relations, powerful men using media manipulations of public opinion to trigger war. It is often suggested that the campaign by William Randolph Hearst's paper that led to the US invasion of Cuba in 1898 was the world's first episode of this kind, but the British press deserves these dubious laurels for its actions a full 14 years earlier. The man behind the campaign was the Adjutant General Sir Garnet Wolseley, a skilled media manipulator who often leaked information to the press to effect changes in policy, and who was strongly opposed to Gladstone's policy of pulling out of the Sudan." So Gordon's being used as a bit of a puppet there by the media. Do you want to comment on that, Max?
Just really to say that I agree entirely with your interpretation of the facts as presented.
I see. Again, it's the same today, isn't it? With the babies in the incubators is the excuse for the Iraq war, and this is the first time that this actually happened, and it was the press that was manipulating Gordon in order to do this, rather than actually the government that were wanting to go to war in the Sudan. It was the press. It was the mainstream media. Again, tie that in today, the immense power that the press have. They were really starting to flex their muscles back here at this time in 1884. With public opinion demanding that Gordon be sent to the Sudan, on the 16th of January, 1884, the Gladstone government decided to send him there, albeit with a very limited mandate to report on the situation and advise on the best means of carrying out the evacuation. Gladstone had gone to his estate at Hawarden to recover from an illness, and thus was not present at the meeting on the 18th of January when Gordon was given the Sudan command. But he was under the impression that Gordon's mission was an advisory one, whereas the four ministers present at the meeting had given Gordon the impression that his mission was executive in nature. Gladstone felt that this was a deft political move. Public opinion would be satisfied with Chinese Gordon going to the Sudan, but at the same time, Gordon was given such a limited mandate that the evacuation would proceed as planned. The cabinet felt very uncomfortable with the appointment, as they had been pressured by the press to send a man who was opposed to their Sudan policy to take command in the Sudan, with the Foreign Secretary Lord Grenville wondering if they had just committed a gigantic folly. So we do have a recipe for disaster here, don't we? Gordon thinks that he's in charge, and Gladstone thinks he's been told that he's just there as an advisor. So again, I'm wondering who's really behind the scenes here that really wants him to go out there, because the press you know, the press aren't the puppet masters, are they? They're just a tool that is actually used in this. We can't really see who it is that was wanting this to happen. Perhaps it was to do with the banks.
Could just have been people who had a desire to see the British Empire expand to its fullest, effectively, and to take in all disputed territories. It could be as simple as that. To some extent, I think that you can see that there are parallels between what was happening in the Sudan then and what has happened in Afghanistan more recently, and you can see that there are people in Pakistan who see what goes on in Afghanistan, and they see the way that the Taliban are effectively running rings around the British and American soldiers that have been dispatched to Afghanistan, and those elements within Pakistan then become more militant against the Pakistani government, etc. And you know, who knows, that could have a domino effect of the sort that Gordon feared would occur in the Sudan.
Well, it's actually
to Egypt.
It's actually the same logic was applied to Adolf Hitler and National Socialism. You know, we can't allow this to take off. We can't allow the rest of Europe to see the improvements that they've actually made in Germany. This has to be nipped in the bud. I mean, they prevented the Strength Through Joy ships from actually docking in Britain and other countries because they didn't want the inhabitants of Britain to see the high standard of living that these workers had and that they were having paid holidays on these ships, and that was the logic for going to war in Germany. Was we can't allow the rest of Europe to do the same, basically. And yeah, you know you've got the same happening here. Well, Gordon started for Cairo in January 1884, accompanied by Lieutenant Colonel J.D.H. Stewart. At Cairo, he received further instructions from Sir Evelyn Baring and was appointed Governor General with executive powers by the Khedive Tewfik Pasha, who also gave Gordon a firman, an edict ordering him to establish a government in the Sudan, which Gordon was later to use as a reason for staying in Khartoum. So again, we've got a bit of a contradiction here. The Ottomans have given him an executive powers. But I should imagine that Baring was, opposed to that. Baring disapproved of sending Gordon to the Sudan, writing in a report to London that a man who habitually consults the prophet Isaiah when he is in a difficulty is not apt to obey the orders of anyone. Gordon immediately confirmed Baring's fears as he started to issue press statements attacking the rebels as a feeble lot of stinking dervishes, and demanded he be allowed to smash up the Mahdi. Gordon sent a telegram to Khartoum reading, "Don't be panic-stricken, ye are men, not women. I am coming, Gordon." So Gordon's really starting to have a bit of fun here. He realises he's been played by the press, and he's decided he's going to play them, basically.
So this is kind of where Gordon is a bit of a loose cannon, isn't he? He's somebody with a lot of a big ego and a lot of personal ambition as well, I think, and wants to see a job done properly. If he's going to put his name to a job, he wants it to be done well and properly his way, not to do it half-heartedly according to somebody else's micromanaged orders.
Yeah, he is certainly an individual. Well, Urban wrote that Gordon's most stupid mistake occurred when he revealed his secret orders at a meeting of tribal leaders on the 12th of February at Berber, explaining that the Egyptians were pulling out, leaving to almost all of the Arab tribes of northern Sudan declaring their loyalty to the Mahdi. Given that Gordon himself, in his interview with Stead, had stated, "The moment it is known that we have given up the game, every man will go over to the Mahdi," his decision to reveal that the Egyptians were pulling out remains inexplicable. Shortly afterwards, Gordon wrote what Urban called a bizarre letter to the Mahdi, telling him to accept the authority of the Khedive of Egypt and offering him the chance to work as one of Gordon's provincial governors. The Mahdi contemptuously rejected Gordon's offer and sent back a letter demanding that Gordon convert to Islam. And basically what Gordon's doing here is he's doing the same thing that he did last time when he went into the slavers, and he went there unarmed and he said, I'm the man in charge. You will respect my authority. And if you lay down your weapons, we'll take you on in the administration. And what he's basically doing here is he's doing the same thing. He's done exactly the same thing to the Mahdi, but the Mahdi is a religious extremist. So it's not going to work on him this time. The Mahdi ended his letter with the remark, I am the expected Mahdi and I do not boast. I am the successor of God's prophet and I have no need of any sultanate of Kordofan or anywhere else. Even Wolseley had cause to regret sending Gordon, as Gordon revealed himself to be a loose cannon whose press statements attacking the Liberal government were obstructing rather than furthering his plans to take over the Sudan. Travelling through Corsoco and Berber, he arrived at Khartoum on the 18th of February, where he offered his earlier foe, the slaver king Rahama Zobia, release from prison in exchange for leading troops against Ahmed. Gordon's attempt to have his former arch-enemy, Zobir, the king of the slavers, whom he had hunted for years and whose son he had executed, installed as the new Sultan of the Sudan, appalled Gladstone and offended his former admirers in the anti-slavery society. And he is going a little bit off-piste here, I think. You got any comments on this, Max?
Well, I think I have to agree with you. I think that... They describe in the text Gordon as a loose cannon, and I've described him as a bit of a loose cannon earlier on. And I think it's he's perhaps become a little bit strong-headed and carried away with his own view of himself as an adventurer and a king-making adventurer, I suppose. That's perhaps the best way to describe him. And so here he is, not actually pursuing these adventures for his own financial gain, but pursuing these adventures for just the sheer thrill and the glory of doing it.
Yeah, I think that's it. It's for the glory, isn't it? It's certainly not for financial gain. He only takes like 10% of the wages. He gives 90% away to charity. After arriving in Khartoum, Gordon announced that on the grounds of honour, he would not evacuate Khartoum, but rather would hold the city against the Mahdi. He was well received by a crowd of about 9,000 during his return, where the crowd continually chanted, Father and Sultan. Gordon assured the people of Khartoum in a speech delivered in his rough-hewn Arabic that the Mahdi was coming with his army of Islam marching under their black banners, but to have no fear, as here he would be stopped. Gordon had a garrison of about 8,000 soldiers armed with Remington rifles, together with a colossal ammunition dump containing millions of rounds. He commenced the task of sending the women, children, sick and wounded to Egypt, and about 2,500 people had been removed before the Mahdi's forces started closing in on Khartoum. Gordon hoped to have the influential local leader, Sebir Rama, appointed to take control of Sudan, but the British government refused to support a former slaver. During this time in Khartoum, Gordon befriended the Irish journalist Frank Powers, who was the Times London correspondent in the Sudan. Powers was delighted that the charismatic Gordon had no anti-Catholic prejudices and treated him as an equal. The hero-worshipping Powers wrote about Gordon, "He is indeed, I believe, the greatest man of this century." Gordon granted Powers privileged access, and in return, Powers started to write a series of popular articles for the Times depicting Gordon as the solitary hero taking on a vast horde of fanatical Muslims. Gordon made all of his personal dispatches to London public. There was no official Secrets Act at the time. In his attempts to win public opinion over to his policy, writing on one dispatch, "Not secret as far as I'm concerned," at one point, Gordon suggested in a telegram to Gladstone that the notoriously corrupt Ottoman Sultan Abdul Hamid II could be bribed into sending 3,000 Ottoman troops for the relief of Khartoum, and if the British government was unwilling or unable to pay that amount, he was certain that either Pope Leo XIII or a group of American millionaires would be. And he's really having some fun here. He's really like getting his own back on the government here, I think, for what he's seeing, some of the worst things that he's seeing going on with the banks and the British Empire. when Gordon decided to stay and hold Khartoum despite the orders of the Gladstone government to merely report about the best means of supervising the evacuation of the Sudan. Powers, who acted as Gordon's unofficial press attaché, wrote in the Times, "We are daily expecting British troops. We cannot bring ourselves to believe that we are to be abandoned." In his diary, Gordon wrote, "I own to having been very insubordinate to Her Majesty's government and its officials, but it is my nature, and I cannot help it. I fear I have not even tried to play battledore and shuttlecock with them. I know if I was chief, I would never employ myself, for I am incorrigible."
That's fantastic.
He's great, isn't he? Because of public opinion, the government dared not sack Gordon, but the cabinet was extremely angry about his insubordination, with many privately saying if Gordon wanted to defy orders by holding Khartoum, then he only deserved what he was going to get. Gladstone himself took Gordon's attacks on his Sudan policy very personally, and one cabinet minister wrote, "The London newspapers and the Tories clamour for an expedition to Khartoum. The former from ignorance, the latter because it is the best model of embarrassing us. Of course, it is not an impossible undertaking, but it is melancholy to think of the waste of lives and the treasure which it must involve." The cabinet itself was divided and confused about just what to do about the Sudan crisis, leading to a highly dysfunctional style of decision-making. Because his Turkish, Egyptian, and many of his Sudanese troops were Muslim, Gordon refrained in public from describing his battle with the Mahdi as a religious war, but Gordon's diary showed he viewed himself as a Christian champion, fighting against the Mahdi just as much for God as for queen and country. The Mahdi and his followers had been fighting a jihad since 1881 and looked forward to taking on the famous General Gordon as a chance to win glory for Allah. Gordon energetically organised the defence of Khartoum right from the moment he arrived there, using his training as a military engineer to turn the city into a fortress. Additionally, Gordon had guns and armoured plating attached to the paddle wheel steamers stationed at Khartoum to create his own private riverine navy that served as an effective force against the Ansar. The Turkish troops at Khartoum were not part of the Ottoman army, but rather the Bashi Bazooks, the irregulars whom Gordon commented were good for raids, but useless for battle. The Shagiyeh, one of the few Arab tribes who did not rally to the Mahdi, drove Gordon to distraction, with Gordon writing in his diary about them, "Dreadful lot, how I look forward to their disbandment." Gordon had a low opinion of the Egyptian, Turkish, and Arab Sudanese troops under his command, whom he constantly disparaged as a mutinous, badly disciplined, and ill-trained rabble, good only for looting. But he had a much higher opinion of his black Sudanese soldiers. Most of them were former slaves who would rather die fighting as free men than live as slaves again. It was well known that the Mahdi's forces were going to enslave the blacks of Khartoum once they took the city. The black Sudanese troops, many from what is now South Sudan, proved to be Gordon's best troops at Khartoum, and they numbered about 2,300. And after that, we get into the siege. Have you got any comments you'd like to make on that, Max?
Oh, well, just read. His story is turning into a kind of Indiana Jones kind of adventure, isn't it?
Yeah, you can see why they made a film out of it. You know, they made a film out of the siege of Khartoum. Because all these events that went on, and he's led a really exciting life, basically. And I think he knows that this is where he's going to go out in a blaze of glory. And he's going to have a lot of fun while doing it as well, especially with these dispatches to the Times. And you can imagine the British public are just waiting to read the next newspaper and read the next missive from Gordon, who's out there surrounded by these crazy Muslims. And he and the public are all behind him, and they're saying, you know, you've got to go out there and rescue Gordon. You've got to go out there and fight the Muslims. And Gladstone is like, oh no, you know, we can't possibly do that. Think of the money that it's going to cost. And the Tories at the same time, they're going for Gladstone as well. And Gordon's having the time of his life. I mean, he really is the center of attention here, and he's really getting a chance to mock the government and the people that he felt should have done better. And when you think about it, the advice that he's given all along this time has been correct. The advice that he gave in China, that they needed to treat the Han Chinese better. The advice that he gave them again about making peace and not going to war against Russia. The advice that he was giving the Ottomans about stopping the floggings and treating their people better. All the way along, he's been given good advice, and all the way along, he's been let down by his superiors. They've all turned out to be corrupt or to be more interested in the money than actually the people that they're supposed to be governing. And I think he sees this as his chance to defend the little man. I mean, that's how he sees these blacks. He's, because they're former slaves, they're right at the bottom of the pecking order, and Gordon is going to prevent them from being enslaved by the Islamic State. And I think that's the true British spirit there, is to look after those of you who are smaller. The big man looks after the smaller man. He doesn't oppress the smaller man. And Gordon is that example, I think.
I think to an extent, Gordon perhaps has become disenchanted with government and with following government orders, and he's kind of in a place now. And the African continent presented itself as an enormous playground, I think, to people of Gordon's caliber at that particular time, because he could have just gone back to some ordinary pen pushing job. Where the rest of his life would have been boring and he would have achieved nothing. But Africa presented him with the opportunity to, as you say, go out in a blaze of glory and to have a rollicking adventure that people would remember for hundreds of years, if not thousands of years thereafter, where he was a kind of Indiana Jones character, scraping together the sort of forces that he could possibly find, many of which were unreliable, and pitting himself against, you know, what he saw as the religious enemy, the Mahdi and the Muslims, and fighting a Christian war on his own terms, effectively.
Yeah, I mean, this was the great battle of the times. You got the religious aspect to it there as well, the Christian against the Islamic army. You've got the big guy looking out for the little guy, and then you've got all the British public waiting on tenderhooks to read his next message that's been sent out from Khartoum, because as we'll hear next week, he gets under siege, basically, and that's the name of the movie, The Siege of Khartoum.
And just say before we finish, it's almost like being a film star, in the sense that you are like the last action hero, as sort of portrayed by Arnold Schwarzenegger, where, but instead of his adventures being on the silver screen, his adventures were actually lived in real life.
Well, yeah, and you wonder how many other characters there are like this in the British Empire. I mean, this presented the chance for that to happen. And as we've shown, you had people that, you know, worked their way up from being absolutely nothing to being the governors of these countries, and they had these battles, they had all these intrigues. I mean, it was an amazing time to be a young British man, I think, in the time of the British Empire. Well, let's get into our greatest Britons. I think we're on to part six of Major General Charles George Gordon's life. I mean, he is such an interesting character here, a fantastic character, also known as Chinese Gordon, Gordon Pasha, and Gordon of Khartoum. And we'll just start with a recap of where we got to last week. In 1881, the Mahdi proclaims a jihad against the Egyptian state in the Sudan, and Gordon is manipulated into supporting Britain going to war against these Islamic extremists, which is against Prime Minister Gladstone's policy. He is sent over to Sudan to oversee the evacuation of the troops and the British people that are there in Sudan, but he is under the impression that he has an executive role, not just an advisory one. And Gladstone was under the impression he was just there under an advisory role. He arrives to great cheers and acclaim, but he fails to win the Mahdi over and decides that he is honour bound to defend Khartoum from the jihadis rather than simply evacuate the city. Although he did evacuate the children and the women and the wounded, he did evacuate them, and then he stayed there with his troops. He also starts writing directly to the British public through the Times, through their foreign correspondent, who is with him. And after we finished last week, Max, I just thought, that reminds me of how Donald Trump is today communicating with his people through Twitter. He has 88 million followers on Twitter, and he manages to completely bypass the press and talk directly to the people. Well, 140 years ago, the press were much better than they are today. And Gordon was able to just write these letters and the foreign correspondent would send them to the Times, and he was able to communicate directly with the public like that, instead of having to communicate through the government and the government then telling the public what they wanted the public to know about Gordon, because he was such a huge and such a well-liked figure amongst the public. And this was a real coup for him to be able to just communicate directly with them. And it played a big part in the actual siege of Khartoum and what went on that we'll hear about today. Do you want to add anything to that recap, Max?
Just to say how things have changed. You know, the fact that the Times would actually print something that was radically patriotic in defiance of the government is just absolutely incredible. When the press nowadays will use their influence in order to stifle any message from patriotic people to the ordinary people of this country. And so during that 140 years, what we've seen is the forces of authoritarianism and of globalism have now reached a point where they have been able to effectively take over our entire mass media and prevent the mass media from behaving in the way that they used to in the times of Gordon. And now it's only with the advent of the internet that we've now got a means to speak directly to large numbers of our own people again. And so let's hope that the freedom of the internet continues for some considerable time, and perhaps forever, hopefully. And then we can make sure that our voice gets through and our message gets through, and we are able to turn things around.
Yeah, it's been completely subverted since then, the subversion of the press. They took what they were doing much more seriously back then, the fact that they needed to speak the truth. And, I mean, they also had foreign correspondents everywhere. I mean, the press doesn't really even have foreign correspondents now. Back then, if you running a newspaper, you would have a man in every country. You would have a journalist in every country reporting on what was happening there.
Well, nowadays it's all syndicated through Reuters, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so we just get the one message, the message that Reuters want to spread, that is then distributed throughout the West, and we don't actually get to find out what's happening in other parts of the world.
Reuters and Associated Press, isn't it? Everything is seen through the lens of those two organisations, and both of those weren't around, as far as I'm aware, in 1880. The siege of Khartoum by the Mahdist forces, commanded by the Mahdi himself, started on the 18th of March, 1884. Initially, the siege of Khartoum was more in the nature of a blockade rather than a true siege, as the Mahdi's forces lacked the strength to wage a proper siege, only thinking to cut the telegraph lines in April of 1884. Khartoum was completely surrounded by the Ansar, but it was not cut off from the outside world for a considerable time afterwards. Gordon's armoured steamers continued to sail in and out of Khartoum with little difficulty for the first 6 months of the siege, and it was not until September 1884 that the armoured steamers first had trouble reaching the city. And we learned last week about how he had basically turned these steamers into waterborne tanks, basically. During this time, Gordon, when he was not organising the besieged garrison with incredible energy, spent his time writing a somewhat rambling diary containing his reflections on the siege, life, fate, and his own intense idiosyncratic version of Protestantism. He waged a very vigorous defence, sending out his armoured steamers to shoot up the Ansar camps along the Blue Nile, while he regularly made raids on the besiegers that often gave the Mahdi's forces a bloody nose. Elated by these successes, Gordon wrote in his diary, "We are going to hold out here forever." So he started off feeling very, very positive there. Just one point I didn't make last week. This word, Ansar, the name for the troops, there's a famous Muslim commentator called Mo Ansar, and I wonder if he's named himself after the jihadi troops here that were being used against Gordon. Do you want to make any comments on the start of the siege here, Max?
Well, just really to point out that the Nile, it would have been the Nile actually provides a ribbon of fertile land that runs through Egypt and the Sudan, etc. And so if you've got armored ships that can sail up and down the length of the Nile, then people won't be living any distance away from the river, because otherwise the land that they're living on will be completely infertile. And so by having those armored steamers, if you were going to shoot up the enemy, you would, just by going up and down the river, you could do a tremendous amount of damage to the enemy. And so that was a brilliant tactical move on Gordon's part.
Yeah, that's what he was doing, just travelling up and down and blasting the hell out of them. Well, to keep up morale, Gordon had a military band perform concerts in the Central Plaza every Friday and Sunday evenings for free, and he cast his own decorations for his men. Though the telegraph lines to Cairo were cut, Gordon used the remaining telegraph lines to build his own telegraph network within Khartoum, linking the men holding the walls of Khartoum to the Governor General's palace, thus keeping him well informed of what was happening. To slow down the Ansar assaults, Gordon built primitive landmines out of water cans stuffed with dynamite. And to confuse the enemy about his numbers, he put up wooden dummies in uniform along the walls of Khartoum, facing the Blue Nile. And this reminds me of the sort of thing that Baden-Powell was doing, yep, as well, wasn't he? It was very important to keep up the morale of the people, and he was putting on cricket games, and they also used dummies to convince the Boers that there were actually more of them there during the siege than there actually were. Perhaps Baden-Powell was actually looking at what Gordon had done, and maybe he took some influence from him, because he was involved in the siege as well, wasn't he?
That's right.
Well, it was not until August 1884 that the government decided to take steps to relieve Gordon, with the British relief force called the Nile Expedition, or more popularly the Khartoum Relief Expedition, or the Gordon Relief Expedition, a title that Gordon strongly deprecated. The relief force, under the command of Gordon's old friend Field Marshal Sir Garnet Wolseley, was not ready until November of 1884. And on the 9th of September 1884, one of the armoured steamers, the Abbas, while on its way to Cairo, was captured by the Ansar for the first time, and all aboard were killed. Among the dead were Gordon's unofficial spokesman, the passionate wordsmith and Times journalist Frank Powers, Gordon's chief of staff Colonel Stewart, and the French consul in Khartoum, Leon Herbin, all of whom Gordon was sending to Cairo to plead for relief. Gordon received a letter from the Mahdi taunting him over the murders of his friends Powers and Stewart, warning that he would be next if he did not surrender. Bitterly, Gordon wrote in his diary, "It is impossible to have any more words with Mohammed Ahmed, only lead." Among the papers captured on the Abbas was the cipher key, which Gordon used to code his messages in and out of Khartoum, which meant he could no longer read the messages that he received, leading him to write in his diary, "I think cipher messages are in some countries like this a mistake." During this period, Gordon was lionized by the British press, which portrayed him as a latter-day Christian knight, a crusader and a saint, a man of pure spiritual goodness, heroically battling the Mahdi, who was depicted as a man of pure evil. The Pall Mall Gazette, in a front-page leader, wrote that Gordon stood out in clear relief against the eastern sky, alone in a black continent. Dauntless and unfaltering, he discharges his great trust, holding the capital of the Sudan against the beleaguering hordes. The defences Gordon had built, with lines of earthwork, mines and barbed wire, presented the Ansar with much difficulty, and their attempts to storm Khartoum had failed so far. But the Ansar made good use of their Krupp artillery to gradually batter down the defences. To counter Gordon's armoured steamers, the Mahdi had built a series of forts along the Nile, equipped with Krupp guns that over time made it practically impossible for Gordon's navy to operate. Well, I'm not really sure what he could have done besides using ciphers. I mean, you've got to have some kind of a code, but you would have hoped that that the actual means to understand that code wouldn't have been put on the steamer that was being sent to Cairo. I mean, that wasn't a very clever idea, was it? You got any other comments you'd like to make on that, Max?
Only that the I believe the Pall Mall Gazette, which from what the account that you're reading enthusiastically supported Gordon, was the a newspaper that eventually became the Guardian, I believe. And again, it just goes to show how much the press in this country have changed from those days. You wouldn't find the Guardian supporting Gordon in his defence of Khartoum nowadays, would you?
No, they'd be doing the opposite, wouldn't they? They would be supporting the Mahdi. They certainly wouldn't be using terms like beleaguering hordes and Gordon alone in a black continent. I'm quite amazed, actually, that the same newspaper turned out to be the Guardian. And by the end of 1884, both the garrison and the population of Khartoum were starving to death. There were no horses, donkeys, cats or dogs left in Khartoum, as the people had eaten them all. Gordon told the civilians that anyone who wished to leave, even to join the Mahdi's army, were free to do so, and about half the population took up his offer and promptly left the city. A note written by Gordon, dated December the 14th, was sent out by a messenger from Khartoum who reached Wolseley's army on the 30th of December, 1884. The note read, "Khartoum, all right, can hold out for years, C.G. Gordon." But the messenger, who knew very little English, had memorised another, darker message from Gordon, namely, "We want you to come quickly." In the same month, Gordon received a letter from the Mahdi offering safe passage out of Khartoum. "We have written to you to go back to your country. I repeat to you the words of Allah. Do not destroy yourself. Allah himself is merciful to you." Gordon and the Mahdi never met, but the two men, both charismatic and intensely religious soldiers who saw themselves as fighting for God, had developed a grudging mutual respect. However, there was a fundamental difference between Gordon and the Mahdi, in that Gordon never tried to convert the Muslims of the Sudan to Christianity, whereas the Mahdi was an Islamic extremist who believed he would establish a worldwide caliphate, looking forward to the day when he would see the whole world bow before him. And there's an important point there, the difference between Christianity and Islam. Christianity expects people to make a decision of their own free will. Islam expects to oppress people until they're forced into accepting Islam and Sharia law. It's interesting to see here that they both got this respect for one another, and Gordon is trying to put a brave face on it, but secretly I think he's really starting to get a little bit worried now. Half the people have left and they're all starving. Do you want to comment on that, Max?
No, just to say that I agree with the points you've made. I think that the message, sending the secret message, was that was a message that Gordon didn't want the Mahdi to hear. He wanted the Mahdi to think that he'd got stores and munitions such that he could hold out for years to come, when in reality he wanted somebody to come desperately quickly.
And I think the British public wanted him to be rescued really quickly as well. There was great pressure that was being put on the government to go and rescue Gordon. During November, December 1884, Gordon's diary showed the stressful effects of the siege, as he was in a state of mental exhaustion, a man on the brink of madness. In his final months, Gordon oscillated between a longing for martyrdom and death versus an intense horror at the prospect of his own demise as the hour of his destruction rapidly approached. Even if the relief force had reached him, it is not clear if he would have left Khartoum. As Gordon wrote in his diary, "If any emissary or letter comes up here ordering me to come down, I will not obey it, but will stay here and fall with the town." At another point, a death-obsessed Gordon wrote in his diary, "Better a bullet to the brain than to flicker out unheeded." In a letter that reached Cairo in December, Gordon wrote, "Farewell, you will never hear from me again. I fear that there will be treachery in the garrison, and all will be over by Christmas." On the 14th of December 1884, Gordon wrote the last entry in his diary, which read, "Now mark this, if the expeditionary force and I ask for no more than 200 men, does not come in 10 days, the town may fall, and I have done my best for the honour of our country. Goodbye, C.G. Gordon." So he's like the captain on the ship. He's refusing to go. He will refuse to leave until the ship goes down. He's going to go down with the ship. He's going to stay there and fall with the town. And he sees that he's doing this for the honour of his country, for the love of patriotism. Do you want to comment on Gordon's state of mind here, Max?
Well, I think that any man that's in a that's in command of a body of people who are besieged for a long period of time will begin to suffer as a result of the the stress that they'll be under, because you can imagine the situation it would have there, where gradually the numbers of his troops would be dwindling as individuals were shot by the enemy, and that the amount of food that they would have would be gradually dwindling. They probably would have to start living on short rations. They probably would have to start rationing the clean water that they had. And all of these things can bring about psychological changes in people. And a great dehydration can have a very pronounced effect on your ability to think straight. And hunger, etc., will diminish your morale quite considerably. And so the fact that he held out for as long as he did is amazing. And but you can understand that the fact that he would be showing signs of mental, well, I suppose mental illness, really. He would be, his mentality would have become ill by the deprivations that he would have suffered: loss of sleep, too little water, and too little food.
So his morale was certainly taken a hit from that, but he was still patriotic, still refusing to go. Well, the Ansar began their final attack by storming the city via a gap in the defence caused by the low Nile. And after an hour's fighting, the starving defenders had abandoned the fight and the city was theirs. The Ansar took no prisoners, and all of the approximately 7,000 defenders were killed. On arriving at Khartoum on the 28th of January, the British reconnaissance gunboats found that the city had been captured and Gordon had been killed just 2 days before, coincidentally 2 days before his 52nd birthday. Under heavy fire from the Ansar warriors on the bank, the two steamers turned back up river. The manner of Gordon's death is uncertain, but it was romanticised in a popular painting by George William Joy, General Gordon's Last Stand, 1893, currently in the Leeds City Art Gallery, and again in the film Khartoum of 1966, with Charlton Heston as Gordon. The most popular account of Gordon's death was that he would put on his ceremonial gold-braided blue uniform of the Governor-General, together with the Pasha's red fez, and that he went out there unarmed, except with his rattan cane, to be cut down by the Ansar. This account was very popular with the British public, as it contained much Christian imagery, with Gordon as a Christ-like figure dying passively for the sins of all humanity. Gordon was apparently killed at the Governor-General's palace about an hour before dawn. The Mahdi had given strict orders to his three khalifas not to kill Gordon, but the orders were not obeyed. Gordon's Sudanese servants would later state that Gordon, for once in his life, did not go out armed only with his rattan cane, but also took with him a loaded revolver and his sword, and he died in mortal combat fighting the Ansar. Gordon died on the steps of a stairway in the northwestern corner of the palace, where he and his personal bodyguard, Aga Khalil Orfali, had been firing at the enemy. Orfali was knocked unconscious and did not see Gordon die. When he awoke again that afternoon, he found Gordon's body covered with flies and the head cut off. Rudolf Slatin, the Austrian governor of Darfur, who had been taken prisoner by the Ansar, wrote that three soldiers showed him Gordon's head at his tent before delivering it to the Mahdi. When the head was unwrapped at the Mahdi's feet, he ordered it transfixed between the branches of a tree, where all who passed it could look in disdain, children could throw stones at it, and the hawks of the desert could sweep and circle above. His body was then desecrated and thrown down a well. And how is that any different to the way that ISIS treat non-Muslims today in Syria and in Iraq? It's exactly the same thing, isn't it? It's beheading. I mean, we've even seen it happening now in France, the beheading of Samuel Paty a couple of weeks ago. So we knew what Islamic extremism was like. We knew what it was like 150 years ago. There's no excuse for allowing it to take place in our countries today. And this is a really dishonorable thing that happened here, because, you know, the Mahdi had given strict orders not to kill Gordon, but they did anyway. And it doesn't seem like there was any reprimand for that. It just shows you that they've got no honor either. They're not honorable people here. This is someone they've been battling against for, I don't know how long it was, probably about a year that they'd actually been battling against him for. Obviously, a very capable enemy that they were fighting against, and they could at least have had the respect to take him prisoner. But no, they beheaded him and they desecrated his body and they threw it down a well. Quite disgusting treatment there. Do you want to comment on the death of Gordon Max?
Well, what I would say is that one thing that the Mahdi did that perhaps wouldn't be done by Al-Qaeda or somebody of that sort nowadays is that he did give Gordon the opportunity to withdraw. And so to a certain extent, he wasn't completely without honour. He did do that. It is, as you say, though, very sad that the Ansar, when they overpowered Gordon, that they then felt it necessary to desecrate his body, and that the Mahdi felt it necessary to desecrate his body as well, because that's just fairly a very grim and uncivilized thing to do, to sort of display somebody's head rotting and being picked to pieces by the buzzards, etc. But yeah, in general, I concur with your remarks, but I would say that the Mahdi wasn't completely without honour, but his troops obviously gave vent to their more baser instincts once they had overpowered Gordon.
Of course, this is the reason why Gordon wanted to save the Sudan from the Mahdi and from this Islamic State, because he knew what was going to be in store for the Sudanese, what was going to be done to them by this Islamic State. Well, the failure to rescue General Gordon's force in Sudan was a major blow to Prime Minister Gladstone's popularity. Even Queen Victoria sent him a telegram of rebuke, which found its way into the press. The telegram was not coded as usual, which suggests that she had wanted it to appear there. Critics said that Gladstone had neglected military affairs and had not acted promptly enough to save the besieged Gordon. Some inverted his acronym, GOM, for Grand Old Man, to MOG, Murderer of Gordon. Gladstone responded by telling the cabinet the public cared much more about Gordon than they did for the Sudan, and he ordered Wolseley home after learning of Gordon's death. Wolseley, who had been led to believe that his expedition was the initial phase of the British conquest of the Sudan, was furious, and in a telegram to Queen Victoria, contemptuously called Gladstone the tradesman who has become a politician. In 1885, Gordon achieved the martyrdom he had been seeking at Khartoum, as the British press portrayed him as a saintly Christian hero and martyr who had died nobly resisting the Islamic onslaught of the Mahdi. As late as 1901, on the anniversary of Gordon's death, the Times wrote in its editorial that Gordon was that solitary figure holding aloft the flag of England in the face of the dark hordes of Islam. His death caused a huge wave of national grief all over Britain, with the 13th of March 1885 being set aside as a day of mourning for the fallen hero of Khartoum. In a sermon, the Bishop of Chichester stated, "Nations who envied our greatness rejoiced now at our weakness and our inability to protect our trusted servant. Scorn and reproach were cast upon us, and would we plead that it was undeserved? No, the conscience of the nation felt that a stain rested upon it." Baring, who deeply disliked Gordon, that's the banker, wrote that because of the national hysteria caused by Gordon's death, saying anything critical about him at present would be equal to questioning Christianity. Stones were thrown at the windows of 10 Downing Street as Gladstone was denounced as the murderer of Gordon, the Judas figure who betrayed the Christ-like Gordon, and the wave of mourning was not just confined to Britain. In New York, Paris and Berlin, pictures of Gordon appeared in shop windows with black lining, as all over the West the fallen general was seen as a Christ-like man who had sacrificed himself in resistance against the advance of Islam. Despite the popular demand to avenge Gordon, the Conservative government that came into office months after his death did nothing of the sort. The Sudan was judged to not be worth the huge financial costs it would have taken to conquer it, the same conclusion that the Liberal government had reached. After Khartoum, the Mahdi established his Islamic State, which restored slavery and imposed a very harsh rule that, according to one estimate, caused the deaths of 8 million people between 1885 and 1898. So the Islamic State actually lasted for 13 years. I mean, that's masses of people to execute, and that was what Gordon was trying to prevent. Do you want to make any comments on the aftermath of the killing of Gordon, Max?
Not specifically on the aftermath of the killing of Gordon, but just to sort of point out here that, you know, what the Mahdi did in the establishment of his Islamic State, causing the death of 8 million people, restoring slavery. We don't hear anything about this from Black Lives Matter, do we? We don't hear them telling us about how the black people of the Sudan were made slaves, and how they were unequal, that they lived in a society where they didn't have freedom and were unequal. We don't hear anything about that. And these kind of issues that stem from the past, the history of Khartoum, the history of Gordon's life, etc., all these things are just swept under the carpet so that the majority of the public don't actually know about this, and they just swallow the establishment storyline regarding slavery, the establishment narrative.
Oh, when you think about it, I mean, this has to be weighed in the scales of history, doesn't it? I mean, when they're telling us that the British Empire was oppressive and the white man oppressed the blacks, well, here you've got one British man that tried to save the whole of Sudan from the Islamic State and gave his life up in doing so, and he dedicated his life pretty much to trying to make the lives of the natives of the countries that were looked after by the British Empire to try and improve their lives. And we don't hear anything about it. You know, this is the sort of thing that should be taught to the children in the British schools, not about the enslaving of the blacks in America, but what the British people did. And you can see that this was a story that captivated the hearts of the whole world. I mean, you've got New York there, you've got Paris, they've got, you know, black lining in the windows. It's the equivalent today of when we have a terrorist atrocity and, you know, the Eiffel Tower is lit up in the colours of the French flag. I mean, it was this important, and it was this really, really good man, good British man, good archetypal Englishman that was murdered by savages, basically, because the British government they just weren't interested in rescuing him and preventing this from happening and looking after Sudan. Well, statues were erected in Trafalgar Square, London, in Chatham, Gravesend, Melbourne, Australia, and Khartoum. Southampton, where Gordon had stayed with his sister Augusta in Rockstone Place before his departure to the Sudan, erected a memorial in Porter's Mead, now Queen's Park, near the town's docks. On the 16th of October 1885, the structure was unveiled. It comprises a stone base on which there are four polished red Aberdeen granite columns, about 20 feet high. The columns are surmounted by carved capitals supporting a cross. The pedestal bears the arms of the Gordon clan and of the borough of Southampton, and also Gordon's name in Chinese. Around the base is an inscription referring to Gordon as a soldier, philanthropist, and administrator, and mentions those parts of the world in which he served, closing with a quotation from his last letter to his sisters: "I am quite happy, thank God, and like Lawrence, I have tried to do my duty." And no more can be asked of any man other than that he does his duty. And but one thing I couldn't work out is who this Lawrence was that he's referring to. I thought it was Lawrence of Arabia, but he was only about 25 at this time when Gordon actually died. You any ideas who the Lawrence is that he's referring to here, Max?
Well, it occurred to me that it could have been Lawrence of Arabia. I don't know. I'd have to do a bit of delving around to find out who that is, if it's not T. Lawrence. But T. Lawrence was quite young, I think, when he started his adventures in the Middle East, and so it could well be T. Lawrence.
Perhaps any of our listeners can shine a light on that. And also, you know, this is a sort of statue that needs to be protected. I don't know if the left are going after this statue in Southampton. I like to think they wouldn't be going after it. They probably don't want people to learn about Gordon because it totally upsets their narrative, doesn't it? It completely goes against everything that we're taught about the British Empire. I mean, this guy was an absolute hero. And it shows you the mentality of the British people and the British public, the fact that they warmed to him so much and they thought he was such a good man. You know, it shows you that we are good people. We don't just have great individuals like Gordon that care about the other peoples and are willing to lay their lives down to protect other peoples. But it shows us that the people that are like that, we raise them up and we honor them and we give them awards. We have a national day of mourning for them. And our royalty, the Queen is right behind him. We heard there about how Queen Victoria pretty much scolded Gladstone for not going there to rescue him, you know, despite the amount of money it would have cost. It was more important to go and rescue him. This man was a real archetypal Englishman that won the hearts of the British people and won the hearts of the people that he was the governor over. I mean, we can't forget all the great good that he also did in China as well, and how he was asked to go back out there a second time, and all the Sudanese slaves that he freed, and how he tried to change the Ottoman system because it was so brutal. He did away with the floggings and really taught the people that he was the governor over that they were human beings and they were worth something. And that was the drive behind most of the people in the British Empire. They weren't nasty, sadistic people that were just trying to brutally extract what they could from the natives. They were trying to improve the lives of these people. And I think Gordon is a wonderful example of it. I would like to find out more about people like him in the British Empire, because I'm certain that was more what they were like than, the Rothschild or Barings the banker. In this, you got any final words on Gordon to say, Max?
Well, not specifically Gordon, but just to say that because of Remembrance Sunday being only just a short while back, I was watching a TV program where they were talking about Commonwealth war graves and how these Commonwealth war graves, I think it was in Turkey. I'm just trying to think of the name of the it's like a little peninsula that British and Australian and New Zealand troops
Dardanelles
invaded. It would have been the Dardanelles, but I just can't remember the name of the actual battle as it was the name that was given to the battle. But the upshot of it was anyway that where this battle took place, there are now war graves that are very sort of fastidiously looked after by the Commonwealth War Graves Commission and local people, etc. But it just struck me at that particular point in time that prior to the British Empire, where we went out to different parts of the world, the war dead were never commemorated like that by anybody else. So, you know, if you look throughout the entirety of North America, there are no Native American Indian war memorials to the Indians that died prior to white people going to North America. If you look throughout the entirety of Asia, there are no war graves, and there's nothing comparable to the Commonwealth War Graves Commission as an organization that raises money in order to make sure that those graves are regularly tended. And so this is an example of chivalry in defeat and chivalry in victory. And again, this is a uniquely and a uniquely European thing. And that's a salutary thing to think about.
I should imagine the memorial in Khartoum is very well looked after. And I should imagine that they still speak very highly of Chinese Gordon. Gordon Pasha, a great man. Well, if you enjoyed that and you want to learn more about our Greatest Britons, then do check out our Greatest Britons archive. And if you want to hear more, on Mondays we have a podcast called Real Britannia. And in the first half of the podcast, we discuss the week's news, and in the second half we do a presentation on who we feel are our greatest Britons. Or alternatively, you can wait until later in the year when I edit those segments together into a complete podcast like the one you've just heard. Thank you very much for listening, and we look forward to seeing you again in the future.